And now it is my pleasure to bring up Bob Harper, who's going to be our teacher today. And let's hope he makes it up here better than Chris Taylor did rounding second base against the Braves last night.
Right. It's one game, Jeff. One game. One game. That's all. One game. And I was thinking you would probably try to say something today, and I thought I would just remind you, next Sunday will be the time for boasting. All right. Well, good morning, everyone. How are you doing today? Good, good. And, wow, you know, it's a crazy time. I mean, that goes without saying it's a crazy time, isn't it? But boy, there is still some good news. The really good news is that we know for sure God is still in control because the Dodgers beat the Giants. I know that you, like me, were very concerned about that. I mean, because, you know, for Dodger fans, we were facing a possible apocalyptic event. If the Dodgers and the Astros were to face each other in the World Series, it'd be hard to decide who you hate more. And so, you know, I was anticipating the zombie apocalypse and, you know, a number of things. So, okay, that was funnier when I thought it than when I said it. You know, just to kind of piggyback on Jen's announcement there, this is going to be a really great event, and I just, the whole idea of like spiritual innovators, that itself is very attractive, but also the fact that we'll have a chance to engage with Brian McLaren a bit. You know, he was here, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago for a couple of days, actually stayed with me. And, you know, you may not know much about him, but, you know, Brian is a guy who really was leading the charge in the very beginning toward more, shall I say, free thinking about faith, being willing to embrace like big questions and being willing to wrestle with doubt. And he was really probing into these issues intelligently. And he took a ton of abuse. I mean, the guy was a lightning rod for criticism. You know, he never once responded in a bad way to all that. So when he stayed with me, I asked him about that. You know, like, you know, how on earth did you do that? And he told me some stories of things that happened to him in the midst of that. I just want to tell you, he is the most Christ-like person I have ever met. I mean, and so I just encourage you, this would be a great way to spend summer, all of your time next Saturday. So we are in this series, Unraveling or Unraveled, Seeking God When Our Plans Fall Apart. You know, I think the two messages that we've had so far have been so good and so helpful. You know, a couple weeks ago, Wayne talked about Peter and that whole incident of him stepping out in the water and then falling, and how Jesus, you know, kind of talks to him about his faith. And, you know, Wayne said, you know, we have a tendency to read that like Jesus is rebuking him. And certainly that's the way I've always read it. And so I really appreciated Wayne's perspective that Jesus is actually encouraging him. You know, there certainly have been many times in my own Christian life when my faith, I felt like I'm going under the water, and to know that Jesus actually encourages in that moment. And I love Brian's message last week. You know, poor old doubting Thomas, you know, not quite Judas, not quite Peter. You know, I always have read Thomas as kind of an Eeyore, you know, thanks for noticing me kind of guy. But, you know, so Brian put some real flesh and blood on him, I thought, last week. Here's actually a brave man. You know, he was willing, like, he knew that going to Jerusalem was life-threatening, embraced that, and was willing to ask questions and embrace doubt. You know, questions and doubt, they're the friends of faith. They're not the enemies of faith. So I've really appreciated it. So I hope that in some way I can kind of move the ball down the road a little bit today. You know, we're talking really about God in a little different perspective. I think it's natural for us to think about God in terms of reward and punishment. If I do good, God is going to reward me, and if I do bad, He will punish me. And so if my circumstances are good, we must be good. If my circumstances are bad, and so on. But I think what we're really getting at here is that many times our circumstances don't go the way we want them to. But God is in the midst of those things actually transforming us and our future through that. So again, I want to kind of go to the same thing. My bottom line today really is something that we also talked about in our recent Ephesians series. And it really has to do with what it means to be a Christian community. That God, the whole point we discovered in Ephesians is that God is creating a church that is incredibly diverse, where there's room for people, regardless of their language, regardless of their color, regardless of their gender, where everybody can come together. And so today, I'm headed toward that theme. We're going to be looking at one of my very favorite Bible stories. I was glad when this came up in the discussion and ready to fist fight to get the chance to tell this particular one, because this really is one of my favorite stories. The full thing is in your notes, and of course, it'll be on the screen. Now, in the story today, we are going to meet some people, and I want to put some modern meaning to those people. We're going to meet a beggar. And so when we meet this beggar, you know, I want you to think about the guy who is standing at the freeway off-ramp with the sign. I want you to think about the person who is outside the grocery store asking you for money. I want you to think about the person who is sleeping on the street underneath a canvas of blankets and cardboard and one thing and another, making a little tent for themselves. I want you to think about the person who is sleeping in their car or their broken-down RV in an industrial area like this. So think about that person right there. Really an invisible person for the most part. We're also going to meet a thief. And this thief, I want you to think of a wealthy man who pays no taxes and does not contribute to the community, but rather takes from it. I want you to think about somebody who starts a company, and this company becomes a global dynamo, and then that guy pays $750 a year in federal income taxes. I'm talking about that kind of person. Now, this wealthy man that we're going to meet, he's above the law, and he's actually a violent man on top of all that. He has certainly a group of thugs who work for him. They don't really enter into the story, but knowing about the time, that's how he would be. He would be that kind of a person. And then the third thing is we're going to meet good people, you know, good Christian people, people who follow the rules, people who pay their taxes, people who keep their lawn up, people who, you know, are living a good, decent life, who don't really take from other people, who understand that there are social mores and do their best to live within those social mores and to be a good neighbor. And we're going to see in our story today that the church is meant to be a place that embraces even that kind of diversity. You know, we talk about diversity and embracing and being inclusive, and we think about the issues of our day. We think about gender issues. We think about racial issues. And you know, certainly we're taking a very vocal stand here. But also, there are maybe moral or ethical issues that Jesus would want his church to be able to embrace those folks. So this story that we're going to be looking at today, like all good stories, has a very important backstory to it. So I'm going to tell you that backstory. The time had come for Jesus to make his public claim as Messiah. The time had come for him to go to Jerusalem, go into the temple, make himself known. And of course, we know how that story goes. So right before that, though, Jesus takes his disciples out of Israel to a place called Caesarea Philippi. Choosing that particular city itself is significant, but won't go into that so much today. But what he wants to do is he wants to prepare them for what is about to happen to them. They're going to take this long trip, this long walk to Jerusalem, and of course we know, again, what happens there. So while he's with them in Caesarea Philippi, he asks them, you know, who do people say that I am? What is the messianic expectation out there? What are people talking about? And so they say, well, you know, some people say that you're John the Baptist back from the dead. Some people say Elijah. Some people see Jeremiah, maybe another Old Testament prophet. You know, it's might be helpful to know that in that day, there was kind of in the general culture this idea that a few Old Testament heroes would come back to life before the Messiah came. So Jesus is getting an idea here of where people are at with him in terms of do they expect him to be the Messiah. So he turns to the disciples and says, well, what about you guys? What do you think? And then Peter answers on behalf of the disciples. He says, well, you know, you're the Christ. You're the Son of the living God. And so then Jesus, you know, the disciples had it right, and so Jesus responds with these immortal words. He said, look, blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this wasn't revealed to you by flesh and blood, but by my Father in heaven. And I tell you that you are Peter, and on this rock I'll build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overcome it. I'll give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. Then he ordered his disciples not to tell anyone that he was the Messiah. So there's a lot here in this paragraph. In fact, this is one of the most important paragraphs in the Gospels. It's a pivotal point in the whole story of Jesus. But I'm just going to highlight a couple things and then, you know, kind of move on. Why, for instance, first of all, why did Jesus tell them not to say he was the Messiah? I mean, he just has asked them, what do people think? What do you think? Kind of congratulated them on their right answer. He's on his way to Jerusalem. They know that. Why did he tell them, don't tell people that I'm the Messiah? Well, it's kind of a two-part answer. The main part of the answer is Jesus had a way to do this. Everything that Jesus does, really from this point forward, and especially when he gets into Jerusalem, has a prophetic point to it. Sometimes that prophetic point, it goes backwards towards things that had been promised and things that people understood would come with the Messiah. And sometimes it has a prophetic point forward. Because Jesus wasn't just fulfilling, he was actually deconstructing and reconstructing faith, if you will. And so he doesn't want that plan short-circuited. That's the primary reason. The second thing is, Jesus does, you know, he'll take a trip from here to Jerusalem, and if you were to take the time and read through this story in the Gospels, Jesus has several encounters with people where he makes it known he is the Messiah. In fact, that's our story today, that happens. And when he does that, he always confronts people. He confronts their expectations, often against their will. And so Jesus doesn't want to be made Messiah by force. He doesn't want his plan overthrown, and he wants also the opportunity to, you know, kind of confront people in truth. And if I could say, this last little thing about Jesus overthrowing expectations and confronting really our expectations, there's great spiritual wisdom in that itself. So, okay. Oh, second thing then is Jesus says, on this rock I will build my church. So these words, this little simple sentence, on this rock I will build my church, this has been hotly debated for centuries. What does Jesus mean here? Some people say that what Jesus is doing is this. Peter says, you're the Christ, the Son of the living God. Jesus says, you are Simon Stone, son of Jonah. And on this rock, on Peter, I will build my church. A little later, I'll give you the keys to the kingdom of heaven, and so on. And so in the Catholic Church and among others, they see this as Jesus saying, I'm going to build my church on Peter. He becomes the first pope, and kind of things go from there. That's one perspective. Another perspective, one that I find more attractive and more appealing, is that Jesus is actually talking about the messianic proclamation. In other words, the rock is what Peter said. So Peter says, you're the Christ, the Son of the living God. Jesus says, you are Simon, small stone, son of Jonah. And upon this rock, in Greek, Jesus uses a different word, a big rock, I will build my church. That big rock being the messianic proclamation that Jesus is the Christ. But the third thing I want to get to, and really the big point is, what would the disciples have thought at this moment when Jesus used the word church? You know, again, to repeat myself, which as I'm getting older, I do a lot. To repeat myself, Jesus has brought these guys apart. They have correctly said, you're the Messiah. Jesus is letting them know we're about to go down to Jerusalem and have this, and have this moment, and I'm going to build my church on this proclamation. What would they have thought the word church meant? Honestly, every time I've read this or talked about it for, you know, 40-plus years, I've always thought about it in terms of what happened after that. Because really, the church has prevailed. I mean, there's nothing in the history of civilization like the church. The church is everywhere. It may look different in different parts of the world, but it is everywhere. It is virtually on every continent. It's virtually in every language. I mean, on and on and on and on and on. Nothing has been as successful as the church. No political philosophy, no economic idea. Nothing can touch the church for success in spreading around the world. So what Jesus said here, it happened. And so I've always thought about it that way. But in working through this message, I thought, the disciples wouldn't have known that. They wouldn't have been able to conceive of something like that. What would they have thought this that Jesus meant by the word church when he said this? Well, the word itself in the Greek is not much help to us. The word is ecclesia or ekklesia, I've heard it pronounced that way, which, you know, it It's where we get our word, you know, ecclesiastical, meaning, you know, church and so on. But in the day, it was a pretty bland word. It didn't really mean much of anything. It was kind of like a meeting, a gathering, an assembly. So Jesus must have invested this word with some meaning. What would that have been? Now, again, to go back to our study in Ephesians, what we learned there was, again, that the church is meant to be this group that embraces tremendous diversity, where everyone is treated equally and people are loved fully. I'm convinced that that's exactly what the disciples would have thought. So they take off on this trip, and this trip that they take from here, you know, it takes up a big chunk of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and a little bit of John. It's a very important part of the story. It's a very interesting trip. Partly because this is where Jesus begins to talk about his death. It's not really a big issue for him prior to this that he's going to be crucified. It's when he takes this trip that he begins to talk about being crucified and resurrected. So, you know, think about the disciples and the emotional whipsaw that this would be to take this kind of trip. Where, you know, you've been with this guy for this period of time. It's been about healings. It's been about teachings. And there have been some challenging moments, but now he begins to say, and the text is clear, begins to say specifically, I'm going to die and suffer. You know, as we learned from Brian's message last week about Thomas, they knew that there would be physical threats to this. On the other hand, it's on this trip that things happen like the transfiguration. It's on this trip that Lazarus is raised from the dead. So there's these two things going on at the same time. So as they get closer and closer and closer, our story is going to take place near the end of the trip. And we'll pick it up in Luke chapter 18, starting in verse 35. It says, as Jesus approached Jericho, a blind man was sitting by the roadside begging. When he heard the crowd going by, he asked what was happening. They told him, Jesus of Nazareth is passing by. He called out, Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me. Those who led the way rebuked him and told him to be quiet, but he shouted all the more, Son of David, have mercy on me. So Jericho is actually very close to Jerusalem, and it's just a few days from this point to where Jesus will go into the temple and make himself known and, you know, be rejected, turn over the tables, and kind of set things in motion that will lead to his eventual crucifixion. It's very close to that. And as he nears the city, as he gets close, he comes to these beggars. And of course, in a city like that, an ancient city, there are always going to be beggars outside the walls. These beggars will all have some form of a handicap. They might be missing a limb, they might be missing an eye, something like that. If you were able-bodied, you weren't really allowed to beg like this unless maybe you were a child. This man happens to be blind. He is in a very real way oppressed by the society of his time, because in the social structure of his time, the bottom of the social ladder would have been widows and orphans, which parenthetically, that's why the church, after it was established, reached out to them so much. That's why you hear so much about widows and orphans in Paul's writings, because they were the very bottom of society. There was one thing lower, and that was beggars. They were the bottom of the heap. So this blind beggar there at the bottom of the heap, he hears this noise of this crowd. What is this crowd? Well, part of it is Jesus and his group coming. I'm guessing there are maybe 20 people counting Jesus. There's something else happening, though. In the ancient world, and from what I've read, it still happens at times in the Middle East today, when an important person comes to a city, the city wants to host them well. It's a matter of great honor in the East to host someone well. The host is blessed by the guest. And so in the ancient world like this, if they see an important person coming on the road, what they would do is they would prepare a banquet for them. And then the leading citizens of the city would come out to greet that person and bring them in, where they would be fed and they would be housed for as long as they wanted to. And then they would be sent on their way. So that's what he hears. And he hears the 20 or so people with Jesus, but he also hears this large contingent of people from inside the city coming out to meet him. And so he starts to call out, you know, what's going on? Because he can't see. And it's interesting what they say to him. They say, Jesus of Nazareth is passing by, which tells you something about what their expectations were at that point. Jesus of Nazareth would have been just what he was called. Like somebody might call you by your profession or by the city that you came from. It's not anything really distinctive. But what the beggar says is really important. He begins to call out, Son of David, which is a messianic term. He recognizes what the moment is. And so he begins to call out to him like that. And the good people in the crowd, they then, those are the people leading the way. They tell him, you know, shut up. You know, keep your mouth shut. You're just a beggar. But he yells all the more. Verse 40, Jesus stopped and ordered the man to be brought to him. So that means he told the good people of the city, the good Christian folks, bring the man to me. When he came near, Jesus asked him, what do you want me to do for you? Lord, I want to see, he said. Jesus said to him, receive your sight, your faith has healed you. Immediately he received his sight and followed Jesus, praising God. When all the people saw it, they also praised God. So again, Jesus orders the people coming out of the city to bring the beggar close to them. We see here a little clue what Jesus is after. Jesus is after here restoring this man to the community. That's a key thing happening here. And then he asks him this question, like, what do you want? Like, honestly, it's kind of a stupid question. I mean, you know, there are other times in the Gospels where Jesus comes up to these people who have, like, issues, they can't walk or whatever, and he says, what do you want me to do to you? I'm like, it's like the stupidest question of all. So isn't it obvious? But it's not quite so obvious, because the beggar, for him now, things could really change. So I said that beggars were the bottom of the social ladder, but they also performed an important social function because people were supposed to give to the poor. They were commanded to do that. And so what would often happen is a wealthier person, you know, to kind of fulfill that, might walk out to the city gates, walk outside of the city, and give a few coins to these handicapped, these people, these beggars. And the beggars would then stand up and make these, you know, exaggerated speeches. This is the most holy gift that's ever been given. You are the most righteous person that's kind of ever been lived, and so on. And so it was an important kind of part of life. And so he had been getting by that way. If he receives his sight, he is now an able-bodied person. He's not allowed to beg anymore. And he's got to find his own way into the community. It is very much a confrontation. And so he says to Jesus, you know, I want to see. And so Jesus says, you know, receive your sight. Your faith has made you whole. And of course, what he means is your faith in the Messiah. Now let me step out of the ancient world for a second and let's talk about the contemporary world and talk about the person who's at the end of the freeway off-ramp, who's sleeping on the sidewalk and so on. We have definitely experienced over the past several decades, you know, in our society, an increase in begging. And we need to be honest about something, that in our society, we have created a culture where certain people, once you get to a certain level or you get below a certain level, it's virtually impossible to get back above it. Like if you're a homeless person today, there is no other way for you to get by. Nobody, I mean, would you hire this person? Would you bring such a person into your home? Well, Shana would, but a lot of you might, honestly. I know you and a lot of you might, but the truth is, it would be a sacrifice. It would be quite a step to be able to do that, and you'd have to think about doing a lot of things in your life different to be able to do that, to bring such a person back into community. So in some ways, we're not that different from the people in the ancient world. Well, moving on. Chapter 19, verse 1 says, Jesus entered Jericho and was passing through. So what this means is that Jesus told the leading citizens of the city, I'm not going to eat with you and I'm not spending the night. I am moving on. And make no mistake, this is an insult. This is the second time Jesus has insulted the good people of the community. The first was with the beggar, and now he's like, no thanks. You know, I'm sure you killed the fattened calf and, you know, maybe got burgers from a habit and so on, but it doesn't matter. I'm not staying. I'm moving on. Now we meet the thief in the story. A man was there by the name of Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was wealthy. He wanted to see who Jesus was, but because he was short, he couldn't see over the crowd. So he ran ahead and climbed a sycamore fig tree to see him, since Jesus was coming that way. So, Zacchaeus, you know, the star of many, many, many Sunday school stories and bad songs about his poor little height. You know, he, make no mistake, he is a very bad man. He is a traitor. He is a person who takes economically from the community and does not give back to the community. He is a person who is despised. You know, the way the Romans did it, the Romans were the great systematizers of the ancient world, and they wanted to know how much income they would have, and so they would basically plan out their budget, and then they would say, this area is going to contribute this much money, this area is going to contribute this much money, and then they would go into that area, and they would make a deal. They'd find a person who's prone to violence, who doesn't have character, who has some leadership capability, and they'd make a deal with them. So this is the income we want from your area. So you generate that income for us, and then whatever you take over and above that is yours, and we'll help you get it. And so Zacchaeus is a guy who has that kind of a deal with the Romans and has surely with his, under his own employ, thugs and bodyguards who protect him and so on. And so, and he's known to everybody. Everybody knows him. Now, he's, so that's one thing about him. The text makes it sound like, you know, Zacchaeus didn't want to join the crowd because he was so short he wouldn't be able to see. Undoubtedly true, but there's another layer to the story as well. Because he's the kind of person that he is, there'd be tremendous motivation in killing him, and there'd be great reward in killing him. And so if he were to join into a group like that, and he's shorter than everybody, they would just kind of move around him like that, knife him, or whatever, walk off, nobody would cry. The Romans wouldn't cry, nobody would cry. Everybody would be happy. Zacchaeus knows this. So what Zacchaeus does next is actually very shameful. He runs. You know, in the ancient world, men did not run, especially men who had any kind of power or stature. Part of it was because they wore dresses. And so, you know, you'd have to like kind of pull it up like that. So, you know, hats off to, if you woman you ever wore a dress, you had to run, hats off to you. But so they'd have to do that, you know, exposing their legs, which is a big part of the problem, but just running itself is bad. So he runs out of the city. Sycamore trees were not allowed inside the city. So he runs out of the city to the sycamore tree, which the sycamore tree has some distinct advantages. One, it's the branches aren't that high off the ground, so it's easy to climb. And then they have these big leaves like this, so it's kind of easy for him to hide. Now, he doesn't think he's hiding so no one can see him. He's just put himself in a place where he's safe. Nobody can sneak up on him. Nobody can hurt him, because all he wants to do is see Jesus. So the crowd is coming through like this. Now, there's a wonderful book called Jesus Through Mideastern Eyes by Kenneth Bailey, and I drew heavily on that book for my message today, but Bailey lived in the Middle East for decades. But one thing he says is as they're making their way through this town, the people are going to be screaming at Zacchaeus, we see you, little crook. We know who you are. And again, they're good people. They've just done a great thing. They brought this beggar into their community. You know, they're going to make him kind of one. Now they see this guy. Everybody would hate Zacchaeus. Jesus surely would hate him. And so they begin calling, taunting him. So Jesus gets close. And then, verse 5, when Jesus reached the spot, he looked up and said to him, Zacchaeus, come down immediately. I must stay at your house today. So he came down at once and welcomed him gladly. So, you know, again, don't miss it. This is a huge insult. You know, after declining their hospitality, which is basically shaming them, he now turns to their enemy, the most hated, most shameful person in the whole community, and invites himself over to that person's house and says, we're coming to eat with you. It's a huge confrontation with the people. Why is it that Jesus keeps confronting the good people in the story? Why is it that he does that? Well, each one of these confrontations has something at the heart of it. The meeting with the beggar has everything to do with mercy and has everything to do with the beggar's faith. With Zacchaeus, it has everything to do with the demonstration of love and what love can do to a bad person. But with the good people, the confrontation is something different. The confrontation has to do with this. Good people, and you and I, we're good people. Good people think they're mostly right. We think we got it 90% or more down. And that as soon as we adjust the other 10%, things are really going to start flowing our way. And we miss the level of need that we really have. We miss the level of dependence. And the problem with that is that we, in doing that, we miss the mercy that goes to the beggar. We miss the love that goes to the villain. And so Jesus would like these people, I believe, like he would like me and you and other good people to recognize our equality with the beggar and the thief on a certain level so that we might ourselves be receptive to the mercy and the love that he would bring our way. So the story goes on. All the good people saw this and began to mutter. I don't think they muttered. I think it was a little more aggressive than that. Well, he's gone to be the guest of a sinner. You know, that's what... But Zacchaeus stood up and said, Lord, look, Lord, here and now I give half of my possessions to the poor. And if I've cheated anybody out of anything, I will pay back four times the amount. Jesus said to him, today salvation has come to this house because this man too is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek and save the lost. Now, about Zacchaeus' statement. In the ancient world, in the world that Jesus lived, exaggeration was a way of making a point. You know, Jesus uses it a lot. I mean, you know, I've cited this example before. You know, Jesus says, you know, if your eye offends you, pluck it out. Whose eye has offended them? We could all raise our hand. Who has plucked out their eye? None of us would. Why? Because we know that's not the point, right? He's using exaggeration to make a point. And it's the same thing with Zacchaeus. He's not actually saying, and nobody hearing him would expect him to actually give everything away. What he's saying is, I am going to change the way that I live. I am not going to cheat people. Rather, I'm going to use my wealth and my power for the good of other people. Zacchaeus, by experiencing this love, by being encountered by it, has been transformed. That's the point of the story. And he's now willing to come into the community itself. The question is, will the good people let him? Will there? It is a little easier to let a beggar in than a thief, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, I got to be honest with you. If I think about the examples I gave in the beginning, you know, between if it were Jeff Bezos or the guy at Target, I'll take the guy at Target. It's much easier for me to be nice to him. It's much easier for me to be real with him. If Jeff Bezos came to my house, I probably wouldn't confront him, but I wouldn't feel, well, you understand, you get what I'm saying. The point simply is this. We are the good people in this story. And God confronts us by bringing into our lives often people and things that we would not naturally choose, people and things we would not naturally want, so that we might see ourselves through his eyes and might actually want the mercy and the love that he wants to give us rather than maybe what we think he should give us. Amen? Let's pray together. So, God, this story is provocative, and I'm sure it was provocative, even more provocative in its day, but just please help us to be constantly provoked by you toward love and mercy from you, but also love and mercy toward others. In Jesus' name.